From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am no longer actively pursuing the presidency.
Howard Dean says he is no longer a candidate, but vows to keep his grassroots movement going. Is history repeating itself with a coup brewing in Haiti? We'll go to Haiti to get a report on the situation on the ground and host a debate in our studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean officially announced Wednesday he will no longer actively campaign for president.
So we will continue to fight. This is the end of phase one of this fight, but the fight will go on, and we will be together in that fight. We will continue to bring our message of hope and change to the American people. We will speak out. We will fight on. We will continue to stand up against the dangerous foreign policy which weakens our security and stand up against this president who weakens our civil rights. We will continue to stand up against special interests that prevent change, and we will stand for America's working families, for jobs and health care, investment in our children, the chance of all Americans to pursue their dreams. We will continue to stand up against the divisive policies of the far right. We will no longer be divided by race. We will no longer be divided by gender. We will no longer be divided by sexual orientation. We will no longer be divided by religion. We will no longer be divided by income. And we will no longer be divided by George W. Bush in the White House.
Dr. Dean's announcement capped one of the largest political turnarounds in memory. Just a month ago, going into the Iowa caucus, he was the Democratic frontrunner, sitting on a record-sized campaign chest and top-name endorsements. But if 2003 was the year of Dean, the early months of 2004 have been all Kerry. Speaking in Burlington, Dean announced he would turn his campaign organization into a grassroots network to, quote, transform the Democratic Party and change our country. He didn't mention either John Kerry or John Edwards by name, but vowed to support the party's nominee. He also urged supporters to continue to vote for him in upcoming races. While he won't actively campaign, Dean didn't officially drop out, so his name will remain on the ballots in the upcoming primaries. A new USA Today CNN poll has found both John Kerry and John Edwards would beat Bush by at least 10 percentage points if the presidential election were held today. Just 42% of the country now feels the president has a clear plan for solving the country's problems. And the AFL is planning to announce today its support for Senator Kerry. The union represents more than 13 million U.S. workers. In Iraq news, The Washington Post is reporting UN Secretary General Kofi Annan plans to endorse Washington's position that direct elections cannot be held in Iraq before the United States hands over political power on June 30th. Annan's expected to make the announcement next week, which could turn out to be a major boost for the Bush administration. But it still remains unclear how an interim Iraqi government will be chosen. A national conference of tribal, political, and religious leaders could be held to choose a provisional government. Another proposal would see the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council be expanded in size and given power to rule until elections are held. In Iraq, two more U.S. soldiers died today in a roadside bombing west of Baghdad. The deaths brought to 545 the number of American service members who've died since the U.S. invaded Iraq. Wired is reporting that the Pentagon's research wing, DARPA, is seeking scientists to develop ways for soldiers to fight up to 5 days without having to eat a single meal. A consultant with DARPA told Wired, quote, "The question is, are there temporary biochemical approaches we can use to squeeze the last ounce of performance out of soldiers when they're already worked to exhaustion. In addition, DARPA is developing ways to lower the body temperature of soldiers in order to prevent them from overheating. President Bush is now backing off a forecast made by his own economic advisors that the economy will add 2.6 million jobs this year. Asked Wednesday about the estimate, Bush distanced himself from the figure. Bush told reporters, quote, "I think the economy is growing, and I think it's going to get stronger." Since Bush has taken office, 2.3 million jobs have been eliminated. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department announced Wednesday the national debt has topped $7 trillion for the first time ever. President Bush yesterday condemned San Francisco's decision to marry thousands of same-sex couples over the past week. Bush said, quote, "I strongly believe marriage should be defined as between a man and a woman. I'm troubled by activist judges who are defining marriage," he said. Meanwhile, First Lady Laura Bush added that same-sex marriage is, quote, "a very, very shocking issue for some people." In Texas, a federal grand jury Wednesday indicted Jeffrey Skilling, the former CEO of Enron. Skilling becomes the highest-ranking Enron executive to be indicted. He's expected to surrender today. A top physicist from California is warning that the nation's nuclear waste dump proposed for Nevada is poorly designed and could leak highly radioactive waste. The scientist, Paul Craig, was serving up until last month on a federal panel of scientists studying Yucca Mountain. Davis said he quit the panel so he could speak more freely about the dangers of the government's plan. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Preparing tonight, Juan, for the big National Association of Hispanic Journalists dinner?
Yes, the annual scholarship banquet is going to be held this evening in New York. It should be well attended.
Juan is the president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. And where does the money go in terms of scholarships?
Oh, well, it goes to young Latinos who are in college studying journalism, and it's the banquet has raised, I guess, over $700,000 over the last 15 years, and all of the money goes to scholarships and educational programs for young Latinos going into journalism.
Well, today we're going to start the program with a very dire situation. In fact, Juan, it's where I first met you, was in Haiti, covering the coup. Mm-hmm. And now the situation seems in some ways to be repeating itself. The situation in the small island nation of Haiti is growing more severe by the hour. There are now fears that the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide could be overthrown in a violent coup d'etat. For weeks, gangs of armed groups have attacked police stations and other government outposts. More than 50 people have been killed. The violent insurgency is daily increasing its weapons supplies. President Aristide's official government forces are ill-equipped to defend against the violence. Haiti has no army, and the national police are estimated at 3,000 men. Aristide supporters have clashed regularly with the insurgents and other opponents of the Haitian president.
In not-so-subtle statements, U.S. officials have been hinting that they want Aristide gone. But Secretary of State Colin Powell this week officially renounced any plans or intervention. For anyone following Haiti over the years, it would come as no surprise that Washington may well be involved. What is particularly troubling to veteran observers of Haitian politics is the fact that some of the leaders of the armed groups are some of the same men who were at the forefront of the campaign of terror in the early 1990s, and that the campaign that ultimately led to the original overthrow of Aristide back then.
In this period, the Haitian Armed Forces and the right-wing paramilitary death squad, FRAP, which was supported by the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies, were the principal organizations behind the reign of terror against unarmed civilians that included at least 5,000 murders, 300,000 internal refugees, 40,000 boat people, and countless tortures, rapes, thefts, and beatings. According to the Haitian newspaper Haiti Progrès, a man named Louis Jodel Chamblain arrived this week in the Haitian city of Gonaïves, where the armed gangs are largely based. Chamblain is the former vice president of the FRAP paramilitary death squad.
Chamblain was convicted and sentenced in absentia to hard labor for life in trials for the April 23, 1994, Roboto massacre and the September 11, 1993 assassination of democracy activist Antoine Ismeri. Chamblain arrived in Gonaïves last week with about 25 other commandos from the Dominican Republic, where he has been living since 1994. They were equipped with rifles, camouflage uniforms, and all-terrain vehicles, according to Haiti Progrès. Since arriving in Haiti, Chamblain led the attack by about 15 opposition commandos against the Hinch police station on Haiti's Central Plateau a few days ago on February 16th.
Among the victims of FRAP under Chamblain's leadership was Haitian Justice Minister Guy Mallory. He was ambushed and machine-gunned to death with his bodyguard and a driver on October 14, 1993. According to an October 28, 1993 CIA intelligence memorandum obtained by the Center for Constitutional Rights, quote, FRAP members Jodel Chamblain, Emmanuel Constant, and Gabriel Duzable met with an unidentified military officer on the morning of October 14th to discuss plans to kill Mallory. Emmanuel Toto Constant, the leader of FRAP, is now living freely in the U.S. In fact, he's believed to be living here in New York and Queens.
Meanwhile, according to Haiti Progrès, another Dominican Republic-based paramilitary arrived in Gonaïves last week. He is Guy Philippe, a former Haitian police chief who fled Haiti in October 2000 after authorities discovered him plotting a coup with a clique of other police chiefs who had all been trained by U.S. Special Forces in Ecuador during the 1991-94 coup. Since that time, the Haitian government has accused Philippe of masterminding deadly attacks on the police academy and the National Palace in July and December of 2001, as well as hit-and-run raids against police stations on Haiti's Central Plateau over the following 2 years.
One of the main leaders of what is being called the opposition in Haiti, Andy Appiah Jr., said recently that armed resistance is a legitimate political expression under a popularly elected government, and that the rebels should remain armed until President Aristide resigns. Apaid is not a Haitian citizen. In fact, he's a U.S. citizen. He was born in New York in 1952. He never renounced his U.S. citizenship, and Haitian law does not allow dual citizenship. Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters, who was on the program earlier this week, blasted Apaid and his opposition front, saying, quote, "It's my belief that André Apaid is attempting to instigate a bloodbath in Haiti and then blame the government for the resulting disaster in the belief that the United States will aid the so-called protesters against President Aristide and his government." In a February 14th news conference, Ira Kurzban, the Haitian government's general counsel, denounced leaders like Apaid, who, he said, quote, "have not hidden their attempts to incite violence and have even condoned it in past public demonstrations where innocent people were brutally killed and where calls were made to overthrow the government."
Kurzban called on the U.S. government to investigate whether Apaid is who is a U.S. citizen is in violation of the Neutrality Act, which prohibits U.S. nationals from working to overthrow foreign elected governments. He said, quote, "In organizing efforts to overthrow the democratically elected government of President Aristide and in suggesting that those who are using violent means should not immediately cease their activities, Mr. Apaid is continuing to violate the Neutrality Act." Kurzban continued, he, quote, "should be investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice, and if evidence warrants, he should be properly brought to justice."
We're going to go first down to Haiti to speak with independent reporter Kevin Pina, who is a filmmaker who has spent the last 4.5 years living and working in Haiti, as well as Maude LeBlanc, who is a reporter for Haiti Progrès. We'll start with Maude LeBlanc. She, too, joins us from Port-au-Prince. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maude.
Hi, good morning, Amy.
It's good to speak with you. Can you describe the situation today?
Well, everything is calm, at least here in Port-au-Prince, and I believe in the other part of the country where the incursion has occurred. Today, everything has so far been very calm. And here in Port-au-Prince, for example, we are, as you know, starting Carnival Week, so people are going about their affairs. Things are pretty stable, I would say.
And are there any areas of the country still under control of some of these armed rebel groups?
Yes. The latest we have learned and we saw is that in the Plateau Central area, that on Tuesday, the FRAP and the former military went into Hesh, and they took over as usual. They burned down the police station, burned down homes, etc. So that was the latest incursion that happened in the Plateau Central area.
Kevin Pina, can you describe the situation and also give some context to what you're seeing right now in Haiti?
Well, I've been talking with several political advisors to the government and other independent observers, and people are absolutely aghast at the fact that the U.S. has not come out stronger condemning the former military and FRAP for the armed incursions that they've made. Obviously, they came across the Dominican border. Obviously, this had been planned for some time. There are questions being raised here about certain segments within the Dominican military that were harboring these people. They were seen on Spanish-language television last evening speaking perfect Spanish, which, of course, makes sense since they have been living in the Dominican Republic for quite some time. We also know that since Trujillo, the Dominican government has a very strong security apparatus. There are questions being raised of how these gentlemen were able to cross the border, the frontier, into Haiti. We also know that there have been 900 U.S. military advisors who've been rotating in and out, helping and assisting the Dominican military to patrol that border. We also know that a year and a half ago, the U.S. government gave the Dominican military 20,000 new M-16s for that specific purpose. So there are a lot of questions being raised right now as to how these armed factions, one, why were they being harbored in the Dominican Republic. Two, how were they allowed to cross the frontier into Haiti in order to make these armed incursions? Yesterday, Jodel Chamblain and Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe is a former head of the commissariat of Pétionville. He was implicated in the coup d'etat against the government in 2002. Jodel Chamblain is a former FRAP, head of FRAP, the Front for Advancement and Progress in Haiti, which was CIA-trained in 1993 through 1994. It was used as a threat against the return of President Aristide in democracy in 1994. Jodel Chamblain was somebody who was described by Lynn Garrison, who was the actual author of the CIA psychological profile against Aristide, as a cold-blooded psychopathic killer. Both of these gentlemen yesterday claimed that they are going to march and take the capital by next week. They called upon the Haitian police and the Lavalas supporters to lay down their arms, that if no shots are taken against them, that they will not perform acts of violence, but that if anyone gives them any resistance, then they will create a bloodbath in the capital. At the same time, the Haitian press, as usual, the majority of the radio stations are completely irresponsible. We have journalists who are actually reporting on the movements of police officers who are responding to the crisis, openly reporting and providing actually intelligence. All it takes is for Jodel Chamblain and for Mr. Guy Philippe to turn on a radio, and they can actually hear reporters talking about movements of police, where they are, how many there are, giving license plate numbers and descriptions of the vehicles that they're using. At the same time, they're allowing people such as Pierre Samedi, who was a former Aristide supporter, to get on the air and to make accusations that Aristide has drawn up a death list, which includes the former president, René Préval. Basically, the Haitian press is acting totally irresponsible, and there are a lot of observers who are wondering exactly why the Haitian government is not sanctioning them and being stronger in terms of responding to the irresponsibility of the Haitian press.
Kevin Pina and Maude LeBlanc, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. They're speaking to us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Is a coup d'etat underway? We'll be back in a minute.
Jodi a ple chante l'amour que m'gen pou. L'amour sa bon finin li marche nan tout fond.
C'est ou ma dole.
Chéri l'or bo kote m sentim nan paradis.
Oui, c'est ou remè.
Le roi vem si doudou m remè j'en caresse.
C'est ou ma dole.
Dans cou de ti pigeon.
Oh, oh, oh.
Sous branche bois kapose.
Oh, oh, oh.
Kapole kot a kon. Juste dans soleil couché. L'or passe mè ou sou moi. Toi me fais chier de pour pas ça imaginer j'en fais ma vie ou doudou.
Talk Vice here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we talk about the dire situation right now in Haiti.
Kevin, I'd like to ask you there in Port-au-Prince. Here in the United States, much of the media coverage of Haiti, the little that there has been focusing on the protests, the massive protests against President Aristide and the continuing problems within the political stalemate over there. But you're seeing a much different situation on the ground. Could you talk to us about that?
Well, the opposition held another demonstration last Sunday, which did not go very well for them. It started with about 1,000 people and ended up with about 3,500. And at that point, the core of that group became very violent. They stoned several vehicles, broke out the windshields, claiming that they were Lavalas supporters, who the people that they were attacking were Lavala supporters. At the same time, it's clear that the opposition is terming this insurrection as legitimate. People are giving proof to the fact that the opposition is refusing to ask the rebels to lay down their arms until Aristide resigns. And actually, in that demonstration last Sunday, people were saying, we're chanting slogans in support of the insurrectionists in Gonaive and in Hinch. And I think that Maud had left out that when they took over Hinch earlier in the week, that they had actually killed the head of the commissariat there. They've been brutal against the Haitian police, merciless, as it were.
We are also joined in the studio by two reporters. We're joined by Jean Belliard Lucien, who is a Haitian journalist now living in New York, director of Radio Lacay, a Haitian radio station, and Raymond Joseph, editor and publisher of Haiti Observatoire, weekly Haitian newspaper that is published in Brooklyn, also a columnist with the conservative New York Sun newspaper and former reporter with the Wall Street Journal. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Raymond Joseph. Can you talk about the situation as you see it in Haiti right now?
Well, if I don't think you can take the situation just as it is today. I've been writing about it for quite a while, and I saw it coming. If you take it only back to the elections of 2000, which were termed fraudulent, the May 2000 elections, and the international community and the political parties in Haiti have tried since that time to fix things up. The OAS, Organization of American States, had more than 25 missions to Haiti to try to fix it up. Nothing happened. And Mr. Aristide kept his parliament, fraudulent parliament, all the way through until its term ended just last month. And it's obvious that Aristide will not listen to anybody. What he wants to do, that's what he will do. He has signed quite a few agreements. He has had about 3 resolutions of the OAS over the past two years that he hasn't lived up to. And so now you come to a point in the road where the opposition to the streets, the democratic opposition, but it's not only the democratic opposition, there are other people. Other people know arms, and apparently this is what Aristide knows also, because the people who began taking up arms against him were his former thugs. And that's the crux of the matter.
Jean Belliard Lucien, is that how you understand it?
Partly, I agree with Ray. However, there is another way to look at the situation. President Aristide, when we refer to the election 2000, did take appropriate step by asking 7 senators to resign from the position. And there were several initiatives, attempt to solve the problem, but we have to blame both sides, because the opposition as well as the Aristide government have been very reluctant to find to find an agreement to really solve this, the political crisis.
In your estimation, the popular support for President Aristide, he obviously still has some, but what is your sense of to the degree that the Haitian people are, especially among the poorest, because obviously Haiti is overwhelmingly poor, the Haitian poor regard Aristide at this time?
At this time, Aristide is still strong among the poor. He has lost significant supporters among the middle class, and the very few he had in the bourgeoisie, I guess he has less them. But as far as the people, the poor people are concerned, he's still strong. On February 7th, he had a strong demonstration in Haiti. Some people are talking about 700,000, others about talking about a million, depending on where the what political spectrum that person is coming from. But he had made a strong showing on February 7th.
I wanted to bring Brian Kincannon into the conversation as well. He works for the International Lawyers Office in Haiti, where he spent the last several years prosecuting crimes committed during the coup of 1991 to 1994. Among the cases he's prosecuted are those stemming from the 1994 Rabateau massacre in Gonaïves by military and paramilitary forces in a pro-democracy neighborhood. Can you talk about what relevance, Brian Kincannon, that has in 1994 to today? Day, 10 years later.
Unfortunately, we're having a return to the same conditions. One of the people who's been leading the terrorist activities in Gonaïves for the last several months is a guy named Jean Tatoune, who was one of the leaders of FRAP in 1994 and is back leading the terrorists right now. He was convicted by a jury in the Rabateau massacre and sentenced to life in prison before he was broken out about 18 months ago. Kevin mentioned Jodel Chamblain, who was the number two in FRAP and generally considered the operations guy, the one who was doing the ordering, the killing and the beating. He's back. Another person who's not back yet, but he's Emmanuel Constant, your neighbor, Amy, who was ordered deported 8 years ago from the U.S. for being a terrorist, but has managed to stay in the U.S. since then because of his CIA connections. We don't yet have information that he's working on the current things, but every time he's been interviewed by a journalist over the last few years, he's always getting calls and talking about that he's still involved in anti-government activity in Haiti. So unfortunately, it's very much real. What was happening then is happening now. It's the same people who are doing it during the de facto dictatorship, and most unfortunately, it's the same people are becoming victims. We've worked very closely with a lot of people in Rabateau, which is kind of the epicenter of the current armed opposition, and most of the people that we worked with have had to go underground, have had to go into hiding. We've two people had their houses burnt and lost all their possessions. The head prosecutor in the case had his house burnt down. So people are really suffering, fortunately not yet in the same numbers that they were in the coup. We need to remember there were about 5,000 people were killed and hundreds of thousands were tortured or imprisoned or otherwise terrorized.
And in the Rabateau massacre itself, how many people killed?
Rabateau massacre, we don't know, because one of the things they did was the military and paramilitary did not let people pick up the bodies, and some were washed out to sea, some were eaten by pigs and dogs. But estimates range from from 12 to about 100. My guess is that 12 to 25 is probably the most accurate range.
Raymond Joseph, I'd like to ask you about this whole issue of these former FRAP leaders now emerging back here leading the resistance back in Haiti. Does that bother you at all, or do you think they're...
Sure, it bothers me, but that's not only that. Mm-hmm. I hear Mr. Conklin and what he said, but does he know that recently the Haitian government had the second Rabateau massacre? Does he know that after Amio Meteye, who was a gang leader, but a gang leader working for Aristide. So if you're a gang leader and working for Aristide, you are okay. And that's what caused the whole problem now. This gang leader working for Aristide was murdered on September 22nd, and his people say that Aristide ordered his murder. And that's the issue. It's not the FRAP people who started all these things. It's a gang leader working for Aristide, and now the FRAP people have joined with them. So that means gangs on both sides have agreed now that Aristide is bad.
Brian Kincannon, your perspective on that?
Sure. One thing, Amio Meteye, and we don't have time to get into it, is a very interesting person. He in fact was the target of one of the targets of the Rabateau massacre, but he wasn't. He wasn't himself victimized because he had friends in the military, and he's always played both sides. He actually testified against us at the Rabateau massacre trial and against most of the people that were considered his constituency. He had to get drunk to do that because he was obviously very much torn by doing that. But he's someone who's always played both sides, and in fact, as soon as he escaped from prison, he went out and called for exact called for, joined the opposition and called for a mobilization, a violent mobilization to end Aristide. So he had gone back and forth several times as to whether he was a pro-government or an anti-government supporter. But I'd just like to comment to the point that this is that this is somehow justified because you have gang leaders on both sides who are opposed to the government. The current government is elected by the people. It's recognized by the international community. And there's a constitution, and the constitution says that the president has a five-year mandate. And just as in the U.S., the presidential mandate should be respected, and that there shouldn't be, regardless of, even if Aristide's popularity drops below 50%, which I agree with Mr. Lucien that it hasn't come close to that. As a matter of democratic theory and as a matter of constitutional law, the Constitution should be respected. There's obviously ways, as there are in the U.S., if a president is violating the law, there are ways of going through an impeachment process. And if people are dissatisfied with his government, they should do that. Or the other thing that's important is people should go to a legislative elections. And it's important to note that the elections in 2000, the only problem with the elections in 2000 that the OAS cited as a systematic problem were those seven Senate seats. All seven senators resigned 3 years ago. The government actually agreed to have early elections 2 years ago. Those are unprecedented concessions. I've never heard of anyone in any country who's you've had seven senators resign to resolve an electoral issue. So the government has made extraordinary efforts to go to elections, to put these types of issues before the people, and the opposition, supported very much by the United States, has refused to go to elections.
I may add to that to what Brian said, because I think that
this is Maude LeBlanc speaking to us from Port-au-Prince.
Fraudulent elections is trying to rewrite history. In Haiti, we are experiencing the same kind of situation, for example, the Venezuelan people have experienced. The problem in Haiti is that we have no oil, and the opposition, the morally repugnant elite, have now taken up arms. They have tried strike, it hasn't worked. Violent demonstration, that hasn't worked. And I think Kevin mentioned on Sunday what they had on Sunday. Their frustration came out, and they attacked a car with a two-year-old kid, and then went on the radio and said that the car had supporters of the government firing on the demonstration, which was a total distortion of the situation. They almost lynched the mother of this kid and the two-year-old person, as it happened when they killed a person because they were wearing a T-shirt with the picture of President Aristide. Those have been totally violent demonstrations, and these people are terrorists. Now they have taken up arms and trying to overthrow the democratically elected government. And the people that are the head, the Louis Jodel Chamblay, remember also this person was accused and was implicated in the death of Antoine Ismaili. We have, the FRAP, we have countless documentation on that. Guy Philippe, former military person that have come into Dominican, from the Dominican Republic, are now the head of this so-called opposition movement. So the opposition has demonstrated clearly that they have refused, although they've taken an excuse from the fraudulent election, they have refused all kind of dialogue. And at this point, the excuse of election, I think it doesn't hold. And the majority of the Haitian people are still demanding that their vote be respected. And that's what's been played now in Haiti.
I would like to add something regarding Louis Jodel Chamblay. Aristide has been accused of installing anarcho-populism in Haiti. There is some degree of truth in it. However, the prospect of fascism that is looming in the political horizon of Haiti with the presence of Louis Jodel Chamblay should provoke the reaction of anybody who claims to be a Democrat. There is no place in a democratic country for people like Louis Jodel Chamblay. That would be a significant step backward, and I calling on the intellectuals, the coalition of intellectuals of Haiti. I'm quoting on all the newspaper, including my fellow compatriot Ray here, that is sitting here. We have to take a strong stand to denounce the presence of Louis de Champlain. We cannot allow that to happen. That will be our responsibility as well as Aristide, who failed to really secure the country properly in terms of containing his people. However, people like Louis de Champlain has no place in a democratic society.
Ray Joseph, would you agree with that?
Definitely. I don't think there is place in the society for gangs. I've been against gangs. By the way, you know, I have not been supporting gangs or dictators. I've been in exile in the United States. I spent 25 years in exile under the Duvaliers because I stood up to them. When Aristide came, I was the chargé d'affaires in Washington. I'm the one who helped secure observers to have good elections in Haiti. In the 90s, if I were not in Washington with Madame Trouillot, we wouldn't have had the first democratic elections you hear about. So, you know, I'm pro-democracy. However, when a president is elected, he does not have a mandate to rule as he wills. And we keep talking about all these things that the Jodel Chamblain and all these people did to the Haitian people, which I opposed. But now, what do we say when an eminent journalist like Jean-Dominique, another journalist like Brion Lindor, are assassinated under Aristide term, right under the eyes of everybody? And when they assassinated in broad daylight.
Wait, he wasn't under Aristide term.
Well, on the Préval. But Préval was Aristide's guy sitting there for him. Everybody knows that. But it's on the Lavalas that it happened. Okay. And all these things happen, and we cannot solve these murders. So I see myself the same thing that was happening under the Duvaliers happening under Aristide, and I oppose that.
Your response?
So let's reinforce the penal system. Let's reinforce the judicial system. Let that work out. Don't have the opposition take up arms to overthrow that government. Let the judicial work, because we have to find out the murders that had happened.
But the judicial system...
With just saying that the government, this government, that with absolutely no proof, and then going and undermining the judicial system to have them do their work.
Maud LeBlanc, Ray Joseph, also Brian Kincannon, Jean Belliard, Lucien. We have to break. We'll be back. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the dire situation in Haiti, is a coup d'etat underway? We have a number of guests with us in the studio, as well as in Haiti. Ray Joseph, editor and publisher of Haiti Observateur, a weekly Haitian newspaper based in Brooklyn. Jean Belliard Lucien, who is a Haitian journalist, is director of Radio La Caille, which is based in Brooklyn. We are also joined on the telephone by Maud LeBlanc from Haiti Progrès, as well as on the phone with us from Haiti. We are joined by Kevin Pena, who is in Port-au-Prince as well. Brian Kincannon is an international lawyer who prosecuted some of the coup criminals of 1991 to 94. The question about the United States, Juan?
Yes, well, The battles in Haiti continue, but right here in the United States, obviously, there's a large Haitian community, and it's a question for the Americans who are friends of Haiti. What should be the policy of the United States government and the international community at this time? What do both of you here who are in the studio think about that, Ray Joseph?
Well, France has just come out and said that it has 4,000 soldiers in Martinique and Guadeloupe, and France is ready to move to Haiti. Nobody knows what they're going to do. Paul responded very quickly, not so fast. We're not going to send troops there. Let things run their way or whatever. Canada said that it would join France and whatnot. Don't forget that in 1994, it took 21,000 American troops to bring Aristide back. And the United States was supposed to help democracy flourish. Since 1994 to today, we see where democracy has led us, democracy led by the U.S. intervention. So I am a little worried about a force, whatever, coming in now and saying they're going to fix up things until we know what they really intend to do and how long they're going to stay there to help accompany these people who just mouth slogans to assume power and then become dictators.
Jean Beliard, Lucien, do you think the U.S. is behind the attempt, if this is a coup that we're seeing in Haiti?
The U.S. has, according to the to Father Adrien, who died like 2 years ago, has engineered the first coup in Haiti. I believe the U.S. is a key player. The U.S. is holding both cards. It's controlling the Lavalas government. It's controlling the opposition. If the U.S. really wants to do to put an end to that stalemate, they know what to do. They can convene a meeting and stop using a double standard, because every time the Secretary Powell made a statement, you cannot really clearly, there is what I consider being a strategic confusion by the U.S. administration regarding their policy toward Haiti. And that must end, because our people are suffering. We need a political settlement, and I hope that the U.S. will play the role as a leader to convene the meeting and force the people to reach a political settlement and strongly condemn that armed revolt that is that is being led by a former death squad leaders, Rougeau del Chamblain, because we Haitians cannot tolerate that. We are not going to revisit that really sad past. We've paid it dearly, and I believe this is a responsibility of everyone. I'm calling on Ray Joseph, that is sitting next to me, on Maudre Blanc, on the intellectual community, on the international community, on France, which is playing also a double standard, because some people, ironically, are saying that France is already on the ground in Gonaïve.
And Maud LeBlanc, I'd like to ask you your perspective on the U.S. involvement as well.
Well, I think when you look at the U.S. involvement, it's obvious that the scenario that happened during the coup, I mean, we all know that the CIA was created by the FRAC in order to get the government of President Aristide to lay down arms, if I can say that. And it's clear in other parts of the world, too, when the U.S. Does not agree with a government, then it does all kind of wheeling and dealing to undermine the workings of that government. So I think the role the U.S. is playing now has been the role that they play throughout relationship. What we also must add at this time is that the, France has taken a position, a forward position in this actual situation, whereby they're talking about peacekeeping, humanitarian, whatever force. And I think this, it's the same strategy, different tactic. We must remember that France, the French, as the colonizer, have brought, the president and the people of Haiti have brought up the question of restitution now. So they react in, apparently to that. And the question of intervention that they're talking about. This opposition has started to make very welcome noises about it. And I don't think that's what the Haitian people need. We don't need any intervention. And I think the Friends of Haiti, as was mentioned before, have to be very clear on what's going on and then pressure the U.S. government to react, to let the Haitian people act and resolve their own problems, because we are able to resolve a problem. We do not need an intervention, whether it's military or humanitarian or whatever they want to call it.
Well, on that note,
the role of the U.S. has been very clear.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us all. This is a discussion we will continue to have. On the phone with us from Port-au-Prince, Maude LeBlanc and Kevin Pena. Brian Concannon was on the line with us, international lawyer, pursued the coup criminals of 91 to 94, seeing some of those reemerge now. Jean Belliard Lucien, radio Le Caille director here in New York, and Raymond Joseph, editor and publisher of Haiti Observatory. I want to thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Raymond.
This is Democracy Now! As we turn now north to Vermont and the major announcement that took place yesterday.
Yes, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean officially announced yesterday that he would no longer actively campaign for president. The announcement capped one of the largest political turnarounds in memory. Just a month ago, going into the Iowa caucuses, he was the Democratic frontrunner, sitting on a record size campaign war chest and top name endorsements. Speaking in Burlington, Dean announced that he would turn his campaign organization into a grassroots network to, quote, transform the Democratic Party and change our country.
The announcement came one day after Dean came in a distant third in the Wisconsin primary behind Senators John Kerry and John Edwards. Dean was 0-for-17, having won none of the primaries and caucuses held so far, with the exception of the District of Columbia's unofficial primary in January that awarded no delegates. Yesterday, he took the stage, addressed a crowd of supporters in Burlington, Vermont. This is an excerpt of what he had to say.
I am no longer actively pursuing the presidency. We will, however, continue to build a new organization using our enormous grassroots network to continue the effort to transform the Democratic Party and to change our country. And speaking to all of you and all of the hundreds of thousands of people around America who are going to get this word either by the establishment media or the internet, I have some things that I specifically want to ask of our supporters. First, keep active in the primary. Sending delegates to the convention only continues to energize our party. Fight on in the caucuses. We are on the ballots. Use your network to send progressive delegates to the convention in Boston. We are not going away. We are staying together, unified, all of us.
And that is former Governor Howard Dean announcing yesterday that he is suspending his campaign for president. We stay in Vermont with Peter Frayne, columnist with 7 Days, the largest weekly newspaper in Vermont. What exactly do you understand Dr. Dean's position to be right now? Suspending the campaign, continuing the grassroots network. Can you take it from there?
I'd say right now he's sleeping in today for the first time in about 2 years. And it's well-deserved and well-needed. I'm sure he's going to be going through quite a physical and mental meltdown here and needs some time to gather himself. What you just heard in his remarks yesterday, anyone could have written ahead of time. Of course, one never admits absolute defeat, even when one is absolutely defeated. We'll see if there's any grassroots organization, but right now I would bet against anything truly effective coming. Amy, I think for the viewers of Democracy Now, what this means is democracy not now. We do not have an opposition party, an opposition voice in the United States of America. Howard Dean ended up, he became so famous because he filled that vacuum. We had both parties supporting the war in Iraq, both parties supporting Bush on No Child Left Behind. It was a frightening state of being with the fear of terror being pumped on us every day by the media as well. Howard Dean filled the vacuum by coming out against the Iraq war. As a result, he became successful much faster than anyone, including himself, could have ever imagined. And I would argue that success killed Howard Dean because his message was a message of opposition to the establishment. You heard that little remark yesterday about the establishment media. You bet he's aware of the establishment media and its power. He criticized the establishment and the media early on. And it was around the time for me in mid-August when he was on the covers of both Time and Newsweek that he reached the pinnacle. And from then on, the tone of the press coverage changed. And it was time to get Howard Dean. And many of those reporters passed through this phone line as they started checking out Vermont and digging deeply into his gubernatorial record and creating all sorts of doubt. There were stories that we in Vermont thought were absolutely ridiculous. After all, we knew Howard Dean, unlike the rest of the country, and he's a squeaky clean kind of a guy. Eventually, all those hits added up and turned him into Swiss cheese and took him down. And the remarkable thing, Amy, I think, is it was the anti-war message that drew thousands to this guy they never heard of called Howard Dean, the Vermont doctor governor. Yet when it came time in January, crunch time, the Kerry campaign, the other campaigns, Gebhardt, the national media, the ads in Iowa comparing him to Osama, made anti-war people feel queasy in their stomachs. And Howard Dean was the newest kid on the block, and they just felt uneasy. It's a feeling in the stomach, and they went out and voted for Kerry and Edwards, and it was the end of Howard Dean.
There's no doubt that the Democratic Party, the standard bearers, the ruling circles within the Democratic Party closed ranks to be able to do whatever possible to kill the messenger. But at the same time, it seems that they were forced to transform their own message to some degree in order to be able to bite into that popular support for Dean. What do you think is going to be the lasting impact, if any, in terms of being able to redirect some of the Democratic Party into more progressive positions?
Right. They stole his lines. Who today, if you landed from Mars and listened to John Edwards and John Kerry, would have any idea they supported the president 100% on invading Iraq? You would never guess it. Howard, they've taken his script. But it's certainly hard to watch it coming from their mouths now and to wonder. But we are now down to that choice between two sides that have the same policies, essentially, and it's just going to be the beauty contest. Isn't John Kerry, I think, I've known Mary Beth Cahill, his campaign manager. She did a campaign for Pat Leahy back in the 80s, and appearance does count in politics, whether you like it or not. And I always credit Mary Beth with the new John Kerry haircut. I think it's working for him.
What will happen to Howard Dean now? Do you think he will run for Senate?
Well, the 2006 in Vermont, Jim Jeffords' seat is the one on the block. Jim says is raising money, says he will run again, but the speculation as he enters his 70s, he may be slowing down. And certainly that's going to be the only Senate opportunity. This year, Pat Leahy's running, Democrat, been there since the 70s. No one's going to beat Pat Leahy, and the Republicans can't even find a serious candidate against him. Howard Dean, who knows? Maybe he'll be in the Kerry cabinet.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Peter Frain of 7 Days, a weekly in Vermont. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduceo, Anna Nogara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.